I'll call my talk tonight Beginnings and Endings. A question that many people ask, indeed I asked myself years ago, is where did it all begin? And over the ages man has conjured up many theories of just where it did all begin, where we came from, where home might be. Those theories range from the attractively mythological to the frankly bizarre and fantastic. There's a group of theories which I've called the Lost World, where remnants of an interplanetary culture exist. And if you think that's a bit far-fetched, on the plains of Nazca, south of Lima in Peru, there are some line drawings of great antiquity. They predate the Incas of the 12th century, so they do go back a long way. The line drawings are of enormous birds, animals, and geometrical shapes carved onto the desert. But they cannot be seen from ground level, they can only be seen from an aeroplane. What about the Easter Island statues? No one has satisfactorily explained how they got there, how they were made, why they were made in the first place. But leaving aside such really speculative ideas, we could go for the scientific approach. But when examined, that turns out to be quite speculative also. We hear that life started from alien microbes carried in from outer space by a meteor. Or if that theory isn't in favour, it was pure chance. In the chemical soup of the primeval ocean, life was sparked by lightning, and that's where it all began. To show you just how important in man's mind such theories of where it all began actually are, I was looking through the Times the other day, through their bestseller list, and I discovered that A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking has been on the Times bestseller list for 176 consecutive weeks. That's over 3 years. For a hardback to be in the bestseller list for that long says that there's something of a cult behind it. But what about other approaches to where it all began or where we came from? Some people make much of flying saucers. Indeed, this part of the world is supposed to be quite famous for them. And some say that the beings in those saucers have come to invite us to join the confraternity of sentient beings in the cosmos. If that's too far out, what about crop circles? Although I have to say, it seems to me very curious that they don't appear anywhere else other than in cornfields. Then there are your frankly mythological cults. Arthurian legend, where Arthur Pendragon and Merlin set the world to rights. There's magic and might in the service of good, and there are remnants of it alive today in secret orders, we're told. Or there are, in the Himalayas, ageless rishis, holy men, saints, masters of psychic power, who are in touch with the source of everything. They're immortal, and they can, if they will, show us the way home. You do have to find them first, of course. So there are many theories of where it all began, and probably just as many as to where it will all end. Many people believe, certainly not so long ago, that the world would end in a nuclear holocaust. Today, the buzz phrase seems to be eco-death, or some such, as the ecosphere gradually begins to get so polluted, it cannot sustain itself. We're already seeing global warming, with the seas rising and land being inundated. It's happening even now. Several Pacific islands have been completely swamped. People have had to move off them. Or will it be through starvation? That seems to be a real possibility. through overpopulation and resulting starvation. I saw a graph the other day of the rise in world population since way back, and the curve was virtually flat, horizontal that is, until about 1750 or so, and then it started to rise exponentially, until by the year 2000 it's nearly vertical. In other words, the rate of increase of population is so enormously high that there's no conceivable way it can go on like that. Something has to give. Well, what about religious views of the way the world might end? We have the Day of Judgment, where all the bodies get up out of all the graves and are judged. That would be an interesting sight, I'm sure. The Buddhist view of the universe is slightly different, and yet does in fact have many things in parallel with those various theories I've been mentioning. The Buddhist view is that the whole universe undergoes periods of evolution and involution, world periods of expansion and contraction. And the Buddha gave a particularly dramatic simile for the length of a world period. He said, consider a rock 1 mile high, 1 mile wide, 1 mile thick. A man at the end of every 100 years comes along and gives it one wipe with a silk cloth. Sooner would the rock disappear than a world period end. Many hundreds of such world periods have passed. Inconceivable is this faring on. Not to be found is any first beginning of beings who, obstructed by ignorance and ensnared by craving, are hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirths. So, we've been around a long, long time, it seems. The endings, the end of the world can come by means of earth, air, fire or water. Earth, physical upheaval for example, air, hurricanes perhaps, fire, heat, drying up of water, starvation and famine, or water, inundation, storms, maybe inundation through global warming, who knows. But it is not truly the end, for the whole process starts again, and again, and again. The Buddha had this to say, after the lapse of a long, long period, this world system passes away. And when this happens, beings have mostly been reborn in the world of radiance. And there they dwell, made of mind, feeding on joy, radiating light from themselves, traversing the air, continuing in glory. And thus they remain for a long, long period of time. Now there comes a time when, sooner or later, this world system begins to re-evolve. When this happens, beings who had deceased from the world of radiance usually come to life as humans and become made of mind, feeding on joy, radiating light from themselves, traversing the air, continuing in glory, and thus they remain for a long, long period of time. Eventually earth appears, and that earth is at that time edible. Those of greedy disposition eat of it and lose their luminescence. Then sun and moon appear, and gradually the whole vast panoply of what we know today as life begins to be established. So beginnings and endings. In between we have samsara, the round of birth and death as we ordinarily think of it. The whole thing is samsara, in fact, but we ordinarily think of the in-between as samsara. The whole complex of craving and suffering is called samsara, otherwise known as the wheel of birth and death, or the three worlds. The worlds of sense desire, the world of form, and the world of the formless. The wheel turns, driven by craving based in ignorance. When craving stops, then the wheel of samsara, the wheel of birth and death, also stops, thereby making visible the nibbana, the enlightenment, which has always been there, but obscured by the constant action of craving and hatred. In these worlds, the main groups of beings are as follows. In the world of sense desire, there are beings in hell states. There are demons, hungry ghosts, animals, human beings, of course, and terrestrial devas. In the form and formless worlds, there are many varieties of devas, of radiant beings, and I'll speak more of those later. All of them go round and round the wheel of samsara, born now here, now there, dependent upon their deeds. Their number is infinite, and the chance for any one, reckoned out of all of them, of being born human, is graphically demonstrated by the Buddha in another simile. He said, imagine an ocean that covered the entire world. There is floating on that ocean a yoke, something like a horse's collar, say. In that ocean lives a one-eyed turtle who rises to the surface of the ocean every 100 years. Sooner would that turtle put his head through the yoke than any being out of that infinite number be born human. The chance of being born human, therefore, is kind of small. And yet, only as a human being can one gain the necessary strength to break free from samsara, from the round of birth and death. The earth is, in fact, a school, and it works something like this. In the world of form and the formless, there are beings of light, beings of radiance, and they exist in unimaginably vast numbers. They are, however, still subject to ignorance and self-view, and can quite easily be drawn into the world of sense desire. Sometimes I'm asked, how come world population has grown so greatly? Where did all the beings come from? Well, it's really not an issue if you follow the argument. There is an infinite resource, an infinite store of beings waiting to be born, if you like. So it really isn't a problem. These beings of light can get drawn to the world of sense desire, essentially this earth and its attendant spheres. If you imagine the earth as the center of concentric spheres of matter and desire, both of which get more and more dense as you go inwards. So you have the earth at the center and then more tenuous spheres enwrapping it as you go outward. Beings born on the earth have forgotten, we've forgotten our heritage, basically. Many come here for the first time from the form and formless worlds, but we cannot remember. And so it appears that this life is all we have. However, humans do indeed visit the form and formless worlds in dreams, and, when more advanced, in certain kinds of meditation. In that first sphere, let's say, on the earth, there are all the interactions of craving and hatred, greed and ignorance, and, of course, their opposites, where they exist. The illusion of dense matter is predominant, and it's very hard to believe that there's anything outside of this scheme of things. Some people get so caught up in the illusion that when they die, they become hungry ghosts. These are beings in what one might call the first circle, the first sphere enwrapping the earth. They're dead, but they don't know it. They're totally caught up in and addicted to the illusion of sensory existence. And if you examine the lives of beings living at that level, you can see them, if you have the eyes to do so, intermingling with ordinary human beings going about their everyday business. There's the policeman on the beat, not realizing he's dead. There's a soldier trying to kill the enemy, not realizing that he himself was being killed. There's one I came across some time ago, a man trying to defend his house from all comers, trying to scare them off, The fact that he's been dead 300 years, or whatever it is, hasn't impinged. He still is so jealous of his privacy and his property that he still tries to chase people away. There are many caught up in sex, only dreamed about during their lifetime. Misers count their money. Drunkards try to get a drink at any bar, and failing that, they try and feed on the enjoyment of the human drinkers who frequent that place. These are people who are dead, but just have not woken up to that fact. In the second circle, there are people who are dead, but they do know it. It's this circle that includes the heavens and hells, and it's populated by all kinds of people, many of whom have strong religious beliefs, including those whose religion is that there's only one lifetime. And incidentally, it's worth saying, I think, that there is really no day of judgment. The only judgment there is self-judgment. The so-called day of judgment is a corruption of what really happens. During our lifetime here on earth, our emotional responses are damped down very, very considerably by being in a physical body and having to express ourselves through that medium. On death, the physical body falls away, obviously enough, and the emotions then are able to be felt in all of their nuances and in all their different strengths. On death, or shortly after death, there is a review of the life that has just gone. And one, as it were, experiences for the first time the full flood of emotional responses to the various high and low points of that existence. So if you've done something of which you are heartily ashamed, you can expect really to feel that strongly after death. If, on the other hand, you've led a pretty good life on the whole, and there are some things for which you can really say you've done the very best you can and feel good about it, then you will judge yourself well, in quotes, after death. In other words, the emotions you find as response to that retrospection on the life just gone will be predominantly pleasant and supporting. The third circle contains what one might perhaps describe as schools and rehabilitation centres for second circle beings who begin to shed some of their fixed views about life. The more open-minded of those people move on quickly, usually to be reborn human. In the fourth circle are helpers and advanced colleges for those who know the score. Some of the helpers are dreamers, in other words, human beings who are asleep nominally and dreaming, and also meditators who are still living a human life. And then, lastly, in the fifth circle are the seniors of the human race, the once returners, the near graduates of the school, which is Earth. Some aim to return to the form and formless worlds. Some are on the way to enlightenment, beyond all the worlds. And it's said that those who have been through the human experience are far more impressive than those who have not, for they've been forged in the fire of experience and have had to learn and develop strengths that beings ordinarily found in the form and formless worlds just do not have. I think it's probably fair to say that all of us feel estranged at some time or another. We all feel deep down that we're estranged from home, from our roots, from the wider horizons that we left behind to become human. Perhaps this accounts for the popularity of the myths and legends that surround our origins. We seek in diverse ways to assuage the feeling of incompleteness. We seek for the fulfillment we believe we should have, but usually in the wrong places. We seek fulfillment in so many different ways. In relationships, in drink, in drugs, in sex. We seek fulfillment through sensation, through living in a commune, through practicing art, style, philosophy. We look to the intellect to provide fulfillment, or perhaps to power and money and things of that kind. There are so many different ways we look for fulfillment. Or on a less extreme note, you can see it happening with people who have moved away from their home base. Expatriates always seem to yearn for home. I've met several in my travels, and no matter how beautiful and how clement the place in which they may be living, they always seem to regard the old country with a deep affection and longing, which makes me wonder why they stay where they are. Or perhaps we seek to belong by joining clubs and groups and societies. Or men and women nearing the end of their lives often get caught up in the whole question of origins. They become closely focused on their earlier life, their childhood even, their early memories. All these quests look in the wrong places. Our true home is quite beyond. The Buddha defined this sense of dissatisfaction, this sense of disaffection. He called it dukkha. And so important did he find it to be as a motivating factor that he made it the first truth of his entire teaching. He defined it like this: birth is anguish, and aging is anguish, and dying is anguish. And grief, lamentation, sorrow, tribulation, and despair are anguish. And not getting what one wants, that too is anguish. In brief, the five groups of grasping are anguish. And what are the five groups of grasping? Just these: the group of grasping after material shape, the group of grasping after feeling, the group of grasping after perception, the group of grasping after the habitual tendencies, the group of grasping after consciousness. In other words, attachment to or addiction to the tangible, sensible world, mental or physical, is the problem. Attachment to, if you like, earth life is the problem. His second truth, the Buddha's second truth, is that craving is the origin of anguish. Craving is born from ignorance and not knowing that there are worlds beyond, and that there is also nibbana, perfection, to which beings are heir, if only they can find their way home. It is the very yearning for belonging that troubles all people. But we can never belong where there is craving and hatred amid this scheme of things. There can only be peace and freedom where craving and hatred are absent. And yet we are all driven homewards. Our very actions provide the spur. Bad action, by that I mean action which emphasizes craving or hatred, is rewarded in the sense of having the inevitable result of increased suffering and a feeling of separation from all that is. The more you become embittered, the more you become hateful, the more you become lustful and yearning for things, the more you feel isolated, the more you feel separated from the true heart of things. This very sense of isolation and this dukkha, this suffering, eventually causes one to change towards the good. Good action, essentially that which restrains selfish craving and selfish hatred, brings worldly happiness and pleasure, and also breeds a very strong sense of communion with all that lives. and with the very earth on which we live. But even worldly happiness and pleasure is in one way suffering. It rests upon fragile foundations and is completely transient. Seeing that, we are driven ever more closely to seek for home. This is the way the universe drives us towards freedom. The futility and emptiness of even the most wonderful worldly conditions ensure that, sooner or later, we are going to seek a serious end to suffering. Taking up life as a human being, each of us has a specific lesson to learn. It isn't completely hodgepodge. There is, if you like, for each of us, a design, a self-chosen design, I might add. We each have a specific lesson to learn before we can advance to the next stage of our journey home. Why might people seek birth in particular conditions in this world? It might be to overcome an enmity. You might have developed tremendous hatred and enmity against a particular individual in a past life. This time, you are born in close contact with them. That hated individual might be a parent, or it might be a child. It may be someone you meet and marry. It could be a neighbor with whom you come into contact and find things get extremely difficult. The lesson there is to overcome that enmity and turn it into love. It might be to overcome a greed for food perhaps, a greed for sex, a greed for power perhaps. I know someone who, I'm pretty sure, was a minor king in a past life. This time he's been born into extremely straitened circumstances, rejected by his parents, led a very poor and isolated life, always lusting for power and never, ever managing to acquire it. We might take birth as a human to overcome a fear of responsibility or a fear of physical damage. We might take birth as a human being to overcome a fear of love itself, being unable to let ourselves go, being unable to trust. We may take birth as a human being to learn tolerance. Tolerance of different racial groups, perhaps. Tolerance of the opposite sex, maybe. Tolerance of different nationalities. There are so many stories, once you start looking into this, of men who have fought for a cause bitterly opposed to, say, a particular racial group, who upon death and a short recuperation are then reborn in the very racial group they persecuted in their previous life. Talk about poetic justice, it really fits beautifully, I think. So each of us has a lesson to learn. What of meditators? What happens to meditators at death? Most meditators, I would suggest, are likely to continue their journey successfully. Obviously, it depends upon the level of commitment and what has been learned. And it is only possible to say that someone will definitely continue their journey successfully if they have reached the level of stream winner in the practice. So that is a point at which to aim, a milestone to get to, if it is at all possible. For at stream winning, there is absolute certainty that one will come to know the unknown sooner or later, in at most seven lifetimes, seven more rebirths, and possibly in the very next. Meditation is quite definitely the royal road. Even though the universe calls us home, as it were, and it is just possible that most of us will eventually make it, it still makes a great deal of sense to follow an accurate map on our journey homewards. The Buddha's Eightfold Path is exactly such a map. It is a way to be practiced, and I can never emphasize enough that it is a way to be practiced. I was in discussion with somebody the other day, and we were talking about religious education in schools. And it seems that the daily assembly and prayers and things like that have completely been dropped from all of the schools. I wasn't aware of this until recently. So there's still religious education, but it's in the form of discussion, often interreligious comparison. So we have Buddhism 1 week, Hinduism another week, Islam the following week, Christianity the week after that, that kind of thing, and then comparisons are drawn between them. Nowhere in any of this is there any practice. None at all. And the person I was discussing with put forward the view that perhaps that is the reason why there's so much unrest amongst the young these days, that there is actually no firm practical application of any ethical way, even at that level. It's certainly a thought. The Buddha's way is a way to be practiced. It's impossible to find the end of the world of suffering by travelling anywhere within the worlds, whether we talk of going off to a desert island, if that's your fancy, or indeed travelling off to the fourth jhana worlds and making your home there. You cannot escape suffering anywhere within the three worlds. One has to go beyond. That is only possible by a systematic training in ethics and mental development. Such a training rejects the emotional fantasies of myth and legend and focuses on what we can know now. It rejects all of the most enticing speculations about where it all began and where might it all end, and concentrates on what we can ascertain for ourselves quite definitely here and now. One of those things is condition-dependent origination, paticca-samuppada. Briefly stated, it says, this being, that arises, this ceasing, that ceases. Very cryptic, but critically important. For example, suffering only arises if there is craving. If craving ceases, suffering ceases. But craving only arises if there is ignorance. If ignorance ceases, craving ceases. So all we have to do, I say all we have to do, is overcome our ignorance and the job is done. Ignorance of what, though? Ignorance of the way things truly are. We believe things are lasting. We believe that they will give us some deep satisfaction. We believe that we can somehow own them, or that they are myself. So, to remove ignorance, we have to develop the wisdom to see that all things are transient. All conditioned things are transient. All conditioned things are unsatisfactory, and that they can never be a support for true happiness and freedom. They can never be a support for fulfillment. And all things are non-self. All things, including Nibbana, enlightenment, are non-self. They cannot be found anywhere within the whole complex of life and the beyond, anything which is a discrete, unique, individual, independent entity. It's these things which we can search for in our meditation. That spirit of inquiry I was speaking about earlier will take us into regions perhaps uncharted by us before. We can look at all aspects of our experience, our sensory experience, our mental experience, and see that every aspect of it is transient, every aspect of it is, to that degree, unsatisfactory, and none of it is myself. None of it is the self of me I believe I have. Another thing we can know now are the four truths. There is suffering. There is a cause of suffering. There is the cessation of suffering. And, critically, the fourth truth, there is a way leading to the cessation of suffering. We can only do this through experience. These things are not to be guessed at or even believed, but known and understood through experience as a human being. As human beings, we are in a uniquely privileged position, for it is only as a human being that enlightenment is possible. The three divisions of the Eightfold Path are sila, or ethics, not as a theory, they have to be practiced. Samadhi, or meditation, not as a hobby, but as a quintessential need. It has to be developed. And panya, or wisdom, not intellect, but a true skill in living at the deepest level, a true understanding that things are transient, unsatisfactory, and non-self. The training allows one to see where home is not, and thus eventually to look in the right place. When that finally occurs, as it will for most people, then the burden is dropped. The journey is made, the task is done. There is no more of being this or that. There is only this that is not nothing, that is to say, enlightenment. Thank you. Thank you.